From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And some perhaps shocking news from the Trump administration today. This morning, the Treasury Department sanctioned 19 Russians and five groups, including the Russian Intelligence Service, accusing them of interfering in the 2016 election and conducting a series of damaging cyber attacks that affected the U.S. last year. Russia has threatened to retaliate. Also today, President Trump joined the British Prime Minister and other European allies in signing a statement condemning the poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter in London, saying it's highly likely that Russia was responsible. In the Oval Office, President Trump was asked whether he thinks Russian President Putin was behind it all.
It looks like it. I spoke with the Prime Minister, and we are in deep discussions, a very sad situation. It certainly looks like the Russians were behind it, something that should never, ever happen. And we're taking it very seriously, as I think are many others.
Tamara Keith is NPR White House correspondent. Tam, this is a president. Hi. This is a president who has downplayed Russian interference in the election, and his former Secretary of State now came out and agreed with the Brits on that poisoning before the White House did. Is this shocking?
No, it's not entirely shocking that the U.S. government would team up with other nations to say that this attack using a chemical weapon on British soil was not okay and a breach of international law. And these sanctions, we should remember, there was legislation passed by Congress and ultimately signed somewhat reluctantly by the president that said that the U.S., that the Trump administration needed to impose sanctions on Russia for its interference in the presidential election. And they are doing these sanctions under that law, though in addition to talking about the interference in the election, they also, the senior administration officials and national security officials, talk about other cyber attacks as well.
Well, U.S. national security officials today are also saying Russians are targeting the U.S. energy grid. What more do we know about that?
Yeah, but there's not as much detail about that as some of these other items, but it is very serious. So the Department of Homeland Security says that based on forensic analysis, they assess that, quote, threat actors sought information on network and organizational design and control system abilities within organizations. They say it is a campaign that is long-term and ongoing, and that these industrial control systems that they've been probing and trying to get information about are the very systems that run our factories and electric grid. Okay. And another just little statistic, the FBI has notified in the last year 4,000 targets of cyber threats. That was in 1 year alone. Often those notifications were made in person.
Okay, well, back to the sanctions for just a second. Some of the Russians and Russian groups sanctioned today have already been indicted by FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller. What's the Russian response been to those sanctions? Have we had one?
Yeah, we've gotten just a very little one that passed through the wires, that a deputy foreign minister from Russia is saying that Russia is preparing retaliatory measures. I think it is notable that these sanctions are targeting the very people that were indicted as part of the special counsel investigation into Russian interference in the election. Of course, Russia is not going to send these folks and their entire organizations over to the U.S. to be prosecuted by Robert Mueller. Sanctions are sort of the best way to target that interference.
I want you to weigh in on Attorney General Jeff Sessions' decision. He has to decide whether to fire Andrew McCabe. This is the FBI deputy director who's supposed to retire on Sunday, but he's accused of authorizing FBI officials to talk to a reporter who wrote about internal FBI and Justice Department divisions over how those agencies were investigating the Clinton Family Foundation funding. This is the backstory. McCabe says he did nothing wrong. His critics say it was an ongoing criminal investigation. He shouldn't have done it. Now, Trump supporters are casting McCabe as part of the deep state. You know, his wife is a Democrat. He's out to get Trump. So what are the political landmines for Jeff Sessions in this decision he has to make?
Well, one of those landmines is that President Trump has been actively attacking McCabe, both on the campaign trail and on Twitter, going back to 2016. And in fact, on Twitter, President Trump said, basically, isn't it a shame that this guy would get a pension and be able to retire? And so that creates an interesting challenge in considering what to do. But the FBI's Office of Professional Responsibility has recommended that McCabe be dismissed over an alleged, quote, lack of candor.
Yeah. Okay, look, you mentioned we've mentioned Sessions, and his is one of the names floating around with possible staff changes. The president today said this was fake news, that there's no, you know, shoes left to drop in this week. But what's your sense with a few seconds here?
I have no idea whether the shoes will drop this week or some other week, but it is inevitable that more shoes will drop because President Trump has made it clear that he believes that he has his cabinet almost the way he wants it.
Yes, we heard that.
So it's likely that more will come eventually.
Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent, host of NPR's Politics podcast. Tam, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, this week, the House of Representatives approved more spending on metal detectors and other school security measures in the wake of the Parkland shooting, but no action on gun control. Parkland is just the latest place to deal with the effects of gun violence. And in Columbine and Aurora, Colorado, memories are still raw. And like the rest of the country, the state is deeply divided over what measures to take to prevent attacks. Allie Budner from member station KRCC in Colorado Springs reports.
Heather Martin teaches high school in Aurora, Colorado. She says a recent gun scare sent the entire school into a red lockdown.
Everybody was freaking out and didn't know what to do. And I'm like, how do you guys not know what to do? Like, we live in Colorado. This is a thing. You know, the Aurora Theater is right down the street.
Martin should know. She was a senior at Columbine High School on Tuesday, April 20th, 1999. Choir class had just started.
A student came running up the stairs and opened the door and said, "Someone's got a gun downstairs and they're shooting."
Martin and dozens of other students barricaded themselves into a nearby office for 3 hours, gunshots rattling the walls around them.
We were definitely under the impression that we weren't going to make it out of there alive.
But they did. Still, the trauma hounded her for years. She dropped out of college, but eventually she found her way back to school, got her degree, and now she teaches 12th grade English. Martin says if a shooter came to her classroom now, she has a plan, and a backup plan, and a backup to the backup plan. She talks to her students about hiding or self-evacuating.
Because I want them to know that they need to take it seriously, so I tell them my story.
One thing Martin can't imagine doing is something President Trump recently proposed, arming herself in the classroom.
And I love my children, and, you know, I will do my best to protect them. But that's just not something I don't think I could ever do.
Another Columbine survivor hopes some teachers will. Patrick Neville was a sophomore in 1999.
I'll never forget seeing a father who I'd known for several years and was running around frantically and couldn't find his son. Never saw his son alive again. I'll never forget that pain in his eyes.
Today, Neville is the House Minority Leader in Colorado's state legislature. Colorado allows people with permits to carry concealed weapons, except in schools and some federal buildings. And Neville wants to change that. Several years in a row, he's introduced legislation to allow teachers to carry concealed guns. His most recent version failed yet again, but Neville says he's undeterred. He hears from his daughter's own teachers, he says, who want to be armed in the case of a school shooter.
It gives me comfort to know that there are teachers who would be willing to protect my kids, but we don't let them.
I'm just going to start off by saying no, I don't want teachers to be armed.
That's Samara Shim, a gentle but fiercely opinionated 10th grader at Renaissance Secondary School in Castle Rock, Colorado. She's sitting around a table with a few of her classmates.
We should be looking at it as, how can we stop school shootings altogether?
Shim and her peers have never known a world before Columbine.
Kind of left like a shadow over like everybody.
That's Jack Pascarello, an 8th grader with freckles and dyed green hair.
I mean, even now, it's still, like, people are still, like, talking about it and analyzing what went wrong.
Like the rest of the country, the students around this table don't all agree on how to respond. Pascarello worries about an unstable student grabbing a teacher's gun. And what if the teacher's unstable?
Like, not every teacher's the sanest person out there.
But Gabe Taylor thinks the system will protect students from teachers who shouldn't have a gun.
They go through all the consistent background checks and very extensive training.
Taylor's a tall, thin 10th grader with a crop of curly brown hair. He's wearing a bullet on a chain around his neck. He says arming teachers is one solution.
In the event of a school shooting, it could completely minimize the amount of lives that are taken.
He also says banning bump stocks and limiting the legal gun buying age to 21 would help. At the end of the day, it's clear these teens deeply crave solutions. Samara Shim says she talks about the issue at school all the time.
Even though, like, I stand for gun control and Gabe stands for, like, the right to bear arms, it's still, we're both concerned about the safety of other people, and neither of us are against change to prevent future tragedies from happening.
And if any answers are going to come from Colorado, a purple state that's home to two of the country's worst mass shootings, it might just come from young people like this, talking out their differences and making their voices heard. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Budner.
And Allie's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. What's it like for Chinese students to come study in America? That's the subject of a new documentary that follows two students as they leave homes and families behind to go to high school in rural Maine. The film, which is in both English and Mandarin, is called Mainland. It won a special jury award at South by Southwest and opens in New York tomorrow. Joining us now is Mainland director, producer, and co-editor Miao Wang. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And why did you want to tell this story?
I wanted to tell the story for a couple of different reasons. And one of them is very much personal, because I grew up in China and I moved when I was 12. And I actually moved to Boston and studied in high school there and college. And now I've been here for many years. So I was very familiar with this experience of arriving as a teenager and being thrown into a high school that's completely different from what I'm familiar with. That experience, I just know it's so unique and it's so formative that I felt like it was a story that had to be told.
And how common is it? How many Chinese students are coming to the U.S. to study in that way?
Well, it was not at all common when I came, but now in the last 10 years, it's been a rising phenomenon. And in the last 5 years, it's exponentially every year more and more students are coming here. And I think this year or last year, there was over 300 Chinese students studying in the U.S. Over a third of the international students studying in the U.S. are Chinese.
Hmm. And you focus on one school in particular called Freiburg Academy. It's in rural Maine. Why did you choose that school?
Well, that school kind of landed a little bit in my lap because I was invited to do a screening in that school for my previous film. And when I arrived, I just felt like this was kind of perfect. There were all these Chinese students there. It was in the middle of nowhere in Maine. And the contrast, visual contrast, immediately came to my mind of, you know, a big metropolis in China versus this quiet, sleepy town in Maine. So when I talked to the admissions director, I just said, well, maybe I can follow you on your next trip to China. And he goes to China twice a year. So I followed him, and that's how the journey began.
And at the beginning of your film, we meet Stella, who's a young Chinese girl who tells you why she wants to study in the United States. Let's listen.
The first time I fell in love with America was in middle school when I watched a famous movie called The High School Musical. The movie described daily life in an American high school. It showed how American students study, play, and date. Instead, I started to dream about studying in America.
So it was a Disney Channel film that drew her to want to study in America. What were some of the other reasons that you found that people wanted to come here?
Well, there were several reasons, and one major one is the Gaokao, which is the Chinese college entrance exam, and it's this gate of passage that every single Chinese child has to go through in order to get to college. So that is so difficult that every year there are more and more people not taking that. And one of the reasons for a lot of the students who want to come study abroad is also just to escape from that exam. And the other reason is a lot of Chinese parents now really want their kids to have an international perspective because they are seeing, you know, China as having a role in the world, and they want their kids to be able to work and collaborate with others in this more global village. And another reason is parents are concerned with their kids living in Chinese cities that are full of pollution, and they kind of want to get their children out out of those cities that are, you know, that doesn't have good water and air. So yeah, many different reasons. And the educational system, a lot of Chinese parents are concerned with the educational system. They feel like it's a bit stifling towards at least some of the kids, and they want them to come to learn, you know, critical thinking, creative thinking, and to be able to succeed in a much more different world.
And of course, for the institutions in the United States, it's a very lucrative thing to do
to bring
these students. Does that mean that all of the Chinese students who are coming to the U.S. are of a certain means?
Well, you know, when I was doing research for the film, I was really hoping to find I was asking a teacher a lot, you know, the mission stretcher. So do you have anybody that come from really nothing and can afford to come here? And the reality is for boarding schools in the U.S., that's over $40,000 a year. Because of that fact, and I think a lot of the parents that do send their kids abroad tend to come from middle class or upper middle class families.
You follow prospective students during the interview process, which seems very difficult for the interviewers from Freiburg. At one point, one of them says, I think they're giving us what we want to hear. Do you think that's common?
Yeah, I think that's very common. And that's part of the reason I really wanted to show that process. And I wanted to show their lives and how their lives are, what their lives are like back in China and what their lives are like in reality in Freiburg and in the school. Because I think a lot of the teachers don't really know what they're really like, and their parents don't know what their lives are like when they come to America. And a lot of times I felt like I was kind of the only person that was there, knowing what's going on both sides.
Stella does take part in activities at Freiburg. She becomes a cheerleader for a while. But you also follow another student from China named Harry, who seems more solitary and thoughtful. Mm-hmm. He chooses Tiananmen Square for a topic for class. What were your impressions of him?
Yeah, when I first met him at his interview, he just had these really interesting, like I thought, very thoughtful things to say. You know, he talked about his dad and how much he respected his dad. Then he talked about also just how much he wanted to come to the U.S. because he wanted to know what critical thinking is. So those really immediately grabbed my attention. And I felt like even though he seemed like on the surface, any normal Chinese boy who seems kind of quiet, introverted, and plays a lot of video games, I felt like there was something more to him, and he had this kind of philosophical touch about him. And I was really shocked when he told me that he actually picked the topic himself. I thought maybe they were just doing it because it was a global studies class, and I thought, you know, maybe the teacher provided that as an assignment. But yeah, he just kind of matter-of-factly said, well, I was very curious because it's something you don't really get to know anything about in China.
Later in the film, we start to hear about the Chinese students' college plans, and Stella talks to a guidance counselor telling her why she wants to study business and not teaching as she had originally planned.
Is that a conflict for you?
My parents pay a lot for me to come to America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if I just teach, I don't think I'd get money back.
So she doesn't even think she can pay her parents back for all the money they've spent on her education in America if she just becomes a teacher. Do you find that a lot of Chinese students who are coming to the U.S. end up wanting to go into something where they'll make a lot of money?
Yeah, absolutely. But I also, I do think that also is all the time changing. You know, I feel like when I came here, that was probably even a bigger pressure. And you know, I'm seeing many more students who are actually studying the arts coming here. So that is changing quite a bit. But most of the Chinese students you see who are applying to the U.S. for school are applying to study economics, business, finance, you know, technology, because those are the more practical fields.
And what about the question of whether they want to stay in the U.S. after they're done studying or whether they want to go back to China? It sounds like it's a real mix.
Yeah. I think that's a question that every student that comes to study abroad also will always have to address. I think some of them might have to leave because it's actually quite difficult. It's very difficult to stay in the U.S. To get a visa after you're a student. It's really, really hard. And so that's a practical reality. And then on top of that, trying to decide if you feel more comfortable being in the U.S. after you've lived here for 8 years during your most formative years, or do you feel more comfortable with your home back in China? And I think it's both. There's a combination of both, and it's a constant struggle, and it just keeps going. So,
what do you think is the bigger culture shock, the one for the Chinese students coming to study in the U.S. or all the Americans who go and try to study in China?
That's a good question. Maybe in some ways, maybe for Americans to go study in China, actually, but just because I think the Chinese know so much about, well, they're so curious about America all the time, and they're always, you know, watching all the American TV, watching everything. They consume everything they can about America, and they're fascinated. And I think when you're in China, you hear about news from the world all the time. But I do feel like in America, there's a little bit of a, maybe people are not as aware of what China is actually like. So because of that, maybe there could be even more of a shock. And also, you know, in China, they're teaching English in Chinese schools in first grade. And I know some of that is starting in the U.S. You know, there are communities that are starting to teach Chinese for grade school students. But I would say the majority of Americans still are not going to be likely to speak any Chinese. And most Chinese, meanwhile, have at least some level of English at this point.
That's Miao Wang, who is the director, producer, and co-editor of the new film Mainland. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And it is a happy day for board office workers everywhere as the first round of the NCAA March Madness college basketball tournament kicks off. Number one seeds for the men, Villanova, Virginia, Xavier, and Kansas. Today, Kansas takes on Penn. Loyola goes up against Miami. Radford faces Villanova. So where are the upsets? What's the status of that NCAA bribery investigation? And why are the Michigan players wearing Larry Bird-like short shorts? Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, start with teams you're excited about.
I'll go off the board. I want to see Duke and I want to see Villanova. I'm really into the Loyola Ramblers. One, they're the Ramblers. If you ever heard me do interviews with you, you could see that I identify with their style. Okay. Secondly, the Loyola, an Illinois school in 1963, played an all-black lineup, won the national championship. Actually, they played four out of five starters, but that broke the gentleman's agreement, so-called, that they wouldn't be more black starters than white starters. They were a fascinating team back then. They've been playing basketball for a long time, but this is their best team in a long, long time. And I really think because they play such good defense, they could pull an upset over the higher-seeded Miami team in the first round.
Okay, people are saying, where were you when I was making out my, you know, whatever, brackets thing? But let's answer
They're a trendy upset pick.
Well, let's mention, answer some of our questions. Michigan players are the ones rolling their shorts at the waistbands, and they say it's because those baggy shorts that go below the knee aren't comfortable. A, do you see a trend here? But B, this is the third seed Michigan playing 14 seed Montana tonight. So tell us more about what underdogs you might be watching.
Yeah, I think, okay, so Michigan is doing the shorts thing because it was the Michigan Wolverines who pretty much started the wearing parachutes as shorts back with their Fab Five teams in the 1990s. As you know, hemlines, as hemlines come, hemlines go. Interestingly, the coach of Michigan is named John Beilein. I don't know if that has anything to do with hemlines. I think Michigan is they won the Big Ten tournament, and they're a very live team. I think they'll beat Montana. And in fact, of all the teams that aren't one or two seeds, they might, and North Carolina, who they could play in a couple rounds, they might have the best chances to make the Final Four.
Okay.
What were the other questions?
Well,
remind me.
I want to just make sure we get to the women.
Yes.
The UConn, you know, one of the top seeds. The women don't start till tomorrow, but UConn lost last year to Mississippi State in the Final Four. We remember that. So just who are you watching on the women's side?
UConn. They have a 93% chance to make the Final Four, according to the 538 model. Now, 538, they're really good at predicting these things. And last year, they said UConn had a 70% chance to win, and they lost at the buzzer. This year, they say UConn has a 65% chance to win the whole thing. And it's not that UConn has gotten worse. In fact, the team, if anything, has gotten better. But some of the other teams, like Baylor or Mississippi State or Notre Dame, have closed the gap a little bit. That said, I think UConn, they won every game this year. I think they only had one game that was a single-digit win. They're amazing.
Okay, the FBI is investigating a number of NCAA teams over these alleged illegal payments made by coaches. Is that affecting the teams, do you think? Because some people think it is.
No, I think they brushed it aside. If anything, a team like Arizona, where the coach was implicated, though he denies it strongly, it could be a rallying cry. A lot of these teams know they have players for just 1 year. Arizona has one of the top players in the country. ESPN reported that essentially was a pay-to-play scheme for him to be on the team. Who knows? Maybe they could say it's us against the world, if not the FBI.
Huh. Mike Pesca, here now, sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Check your brackets with him. This week, we reach another milestone in the Syrian civil war. 7 years. 7 years of conflict, hundreds of thousands of lives lost, cities destroyed, a global migrant crisis, Iran, Turkey, Israel, the U.S., and Russia all drawn in. Today, a relief convoy from the Red Cross has managed to get into the rebel-held enclave of eastern Ghouta, but thousands of Syrians are still fleeing the region. The BBC's Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen has regularly reported from the front lines of this war for six of those 7 years. He joins us now from London. And Jeremy, your thoughts when you hear 7 years?
Well, it's a long time, longer than World War II, longer than many, many other conflicts. And what I think is particularly sad is there isn't really a sign of an ending.
No, oh, well, that's dispiriting. But talk about eastern Ghouta, the suburb of Damascus. We've been seeing the pictures coming out, men with infants in their arms running over rubble after, you know, there have been attacks from the Syrian government. Doctors Without Borders reports more than 1,000 deaths there in just the first 2 weeks of fighting there. Aid convoys struggling to get food and medicine into the region. So how are people, I mean, we've heard the reports of, you know, people in basements subsisting, but how are, what are they eating? What are they doing?
The answer is they're not living off very much at all. There's a lot of starvation there. There are kids with malnutrition. There are people who are spending by now weeks in basements and not moving out of them. And the conditions in some of those basements, we're told, with real problems with sanitation, with running water, often not having either, means that those places are now desperately insanitary. You know, it's hard to think of life being any more miserable because, of course, if they go out in the streets, then there's a real risk they'll get killed.
Right. Look, Jeremy Bowen, for people who might be just looking up now, maybe they're coming of age, you know, of the age where they will be paying attention to world affairs. Let's explain how we got here. Bashar al-Assad became president in 2000 after the death of his father. Didn't want to be president. He was an ophthalmologist, very sophisticated family. Many people thought he'd be a reformer. But then comes the Arab Spring. This is 2010, 2011. Arab Spring movements that toppled despots in other countries. An uprising in Syria against al-Assad. People thought the wave would continue. It didn't. It jammed sort of kind of where it is now. Why? What happened?
Assad was seen as a reformer. He described himself as a reformer, and he probably would still describe himself as a reformer. What happened in 2011 when the uprising started all those years ago, and it started with small demonstrations in Deraa, in the south of Syria, and then it rapidly became militarized. Now, Assad has always said that there were extremists organized by outsiders, by foreigners who wanted to destroy the secular Syria, which he very much supports. People on the other side of the argument said that they were pushing for democracy, and I actually think that he wouldn't have had to have made very big concessions back then to calm the whole thing down, but he chose not to. And I think in a way it was standard operating procedures for the Assad family because his father had been there before him as president, and they had been, you know, his father had been president on his own since, I think, about 1970, and before that he'd been part of a military coup, and he'd always believed in, you know, that at times you have to take out the big stick, and that's the way I think that Assad has been looking at things. The shape of the war has changed. To start with, there were people who described themselves as pro-democracy who were fighting against his guys. They didn't get the support that they hoped for from the likes of the United States or Britain or France. And they lost ground to other kinds of insurgents. And they were people who were different kinds of Islamists. And now, insofar as there are rebels still fighting against Assad, they are pretty much all Islamists of different shades. Mm. And what's also changed in the war, and the war isn't ending, but it's changing, is that lots of big powers have got involved. The US is involved. The Russians are involved. Turkey's involved. Britain's involved. Iran is involved, etc., etc. It's almost like a mini world war now, which means that it's not really something that Syrians can sort out between themselves. There are big powers involved, and in the end, they will be sorting out the future.
Well, and when is the end? Because you say the war is not ending. And there were times when there were hopes, there were talks. You know, there was a negotiation and Syria had to give up its chemical weapons. Russia helped with that. But then we've seen the reintroduction of chemical weapons recently. There was talk that Assad was going to be removed. That never happened. He seems stronger than ever. The Kurds have come in to help the rebels fighting Assad. But of course, that draws Turkey further in, because they fear the Kurdish movements in Turkey. So as you said, it's just this mess. Where does it go?
I think where it goes for the time being is more fighting, different kinds of fighting. But longer term and in a wider sense, I don't see an end to fighting in Syria at the moment. The country is very fragmented. So while I think Assad has pretty much beaten the rebels who took up arms against him in 2011, there are other layers of war going on. So I'm afraid the agony is far from over for the Syrian people, those who are still in the country.
We spoke the other day with a young American, a 23-year-old, who'd gone to fight alongside the Kurds in Syria. Well, in his case, against ISIS, which has also come into this vacuum, along with al-Qaeda. And he said he's just begging for a no-fly zone, meaning there could be areas where at least nobody could fly over and drop these barrel bombs on these civilians. Is there any chance of that?
Not now. No, I think maybe there would have been a couple of years ago. You know, a real turning point in the war was the summer of 2013. If you may remember, that's when there was a big chemical weapons attack actually on Eastern Ghouta near Damascus. Then President Barack Obama had said that the use of chemical weapons is a red line. You cross that red line, you incur the wrath of the U.S. I was in Damascus, effectively waiting to be bombed by the U.S., not for the first time in my life, I have to add. And I'm telling you, the regime was really nervous about what might happen. But at the last minute, they decided not to do it. And I think after that, the U.S. lost a lot of credibility, and the regime had an enormous burst of confidence as a result. I think around that time, if the United States had said, yeah, there'll be a no-fly zone and we're prepared to enforce it, then it probably would have happened, I think. But now with the Russians involved there, the Russian Air Force is very much working with the Syrian Air Force. So, no, I don't think there's going to be. I think the only person who could declare a no-fly zone right now, quite frankly, is President Putin. Mm. And he's not going to.
No. And the U.S. decision was a very complicated one. People on both sides of the political spectrum involved in that. Look, this has created a refugee crisis. 5.5 million migrants who've fled Syria, scattered around the world, strained European governments, ignited a wave of far-right nationalist anti-immigrant politics. So it's reverberated around the world. And yet it's also gone off everyone's radar in some cases because there's a feeling that there's nothing that can be done. I don't mean this in a flip way at all, Jeremy Bowen, but is there really anything left to the country?
Yeah, of course there is. You know, not everywhere is rubble to begin with. Areas where there's been fighting are rubble. The center of Damascus isn't rubble. There are parts of, you know, the other big towns which aren't rubble. If you go to the coastal cities, which is a big stronghold of the regime, places like Latakia, they look quite normal, except for the fact the population has been doubled because of internal refugees. Syria, you know, is a very ancient country. And the people there have tremendous pride in their history. Yes, it's taken a grievous blows, which will take, you know, maybe more than a generation to recover from. But, you know, they've been through a lot in the past. And, you know, in the end, they will get through all of this. It's just taking an awful long period of time.
Awful, the operative word. Jeremy Bowen, BBC Middle East editor. I have to ask, you sound dispirited.
Well, if you spend years reporting from places like Syria, that tends to happen. Of course I'm dispirited about the way things are there. It's awfully sad seeing people who are, you know, who continue to suffer a great deal. And if you think of a war that's been going on for 7 years, it means that there's a whole generation growing to maturity who've known nothing other than war. Half the population is in need of relief aid. I think half the population has lost their homes. Something like, and no one really knows precisely, 500,000 people killed. It's probably more than that. So, you know, yeah, sure, it's hard to see a bright side there.
Jeremy Bowen, BBC Middle East editor. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've talked about the pressure that ride-hailing companies like Uber and Lyft have put on traditional taxi companies and on public transportation in some cities. Now it turns out they're having an effect on parking revenue as well. Joining us now is Mary Smith, who's a senior vice president at Walker Consultants in Indianapolis. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And how big of an impact are these ride-hailing apps having on parking?
Fairly significant. It's happening in certain areas greater than other areas. For example, hotel parking by business travelers can be down 30 to even 70%, probably an average about 50% reduction. Restaurants and bar, especially valet parking, can be down maybe even 80%. We're seeing sports and event facilities start to have some serious problems with pickup after the event, and the data we have shows maybe 3 to 6% reduction in parking due to people arriving by Uber and Lyft. And then we also have airports, which are showing maybe a 10 to 20% reduction in parking. In some airports, it's long-term parking. In other airports, it's the short-term. But the biggest impact really is on taxis at airports.
And what about meters, parking meters in cities? Are people spending less money there?
We haven't seen any numbers show up yet that proves that. I think it's typically longer stays. You know, if you're going to a restaurant and you want to avoid a problem of drinking and driving, it's longer stay than you would probably park at a meter. So we're not seeing quite as much at meters as we are on the off-street parking.
Did this come as a surprise to all these businesses, to airports, to hotels, to nightclubs and restaurants?
I think it did to some degree because in the past there have been things that we thought in the parking industry would really impact us, and then it didn't really happen. For example, the airports were very worried about the proliferation of the super shuttle type programs, and really in the end it really didn't affect their parking revenue, but this really is.
So the airport one makes total sense to me, just from personal experience. It would cost me $35 a day to park my car at the airport, whereas it'll cost less than that just to get to the airport in an Uber. How important is it to these airports' finances to lose that parking revenue?
Well, it's very important because the second largest source of revenue to an airport after the landing fees is usually the parking. So it's a very significant portion of their operating revenues. We've done some surveys at a couple of airports of people at the curb waiting to be picked up by Uber or Lyft, and they say that convenience is more important than cost.
What about at stadiums and arenas? Do you think that they will start to devote less space to parking because fewer people want to park and they'd rather just take a Lyft or an Uber?
Well, they are having – if they're getting 3 to 6% of the cars not coming to park anymore, they are already starting to take out areas and then create larger pickup drop-off zones. Mm. It's not a problem before the event. At special event facilities, it's definitely a problem after the event when everybody wants to leave at once.
What other consequences are you watching for or waiting for when it comes to how this will impact all kinds of businesses?
Well, the biggest thing that's going to happen that could be a really significant accelerant of this of Uber and Lyft is if autonomous vehicles are adopted by what the airports call the transportation network companies. That's their name for Uber and Lyft is a generic name, and we're expecting to see GM start a ride sharing service next year. Waymo has already moved people to the back seat, has moved the driver to the back seat in Phoenix. So we're getting close to being driverless. And then when it's driverless, the cost for the user will come down, and therefore it could be a even more significant impact on parking.
So is it sad to you to look at this, or do you think, wow, great, we don't need to be spending all this money and time and space on parking?
Well, I think we see it as an opportunity, and I don't say that lightly. We see it as an opportunity because what's going to be left is going to be more dense. There'll be changes that happen, for example, when an autonomous car can go park itself, drop you off at the door and then go park itself. There'll be a growth in the need, just as you implied with airports, a need to have more pickup drop-off. And ultimately, we don't see that overall the parking demand will drop much lower than maybe it is today after you factor in population growth. So there's going to be changes and there's going to be challenges, but we really believe that parking will still exist. It'll just change in a lot of the things we consider when we plan and design it.
That's Mary Smith, who's a senior vice president at Walker Consultants. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Nothing more annoying than parking. So in a way, anything that will allow us to not have to figure out where to park is a good thing.
Except if you own a parking lot.
Except if you own a parking lot or you're a city with parking meters. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.